Let me welcome everyone today to the fifth and final talk in the Computers and Reading Lecture Series by our U of A distinguished visitor, Dr. Willard McCarty from King's College London.
Willard. Thank you, Stan. Historical knowledge pulls us in two directions. From one extreme, history is oppression by the dead hand of the past. From the other, it is liberation from witless presentism. The task of writing a history of anything, then, must involve seeing both, being true to both simultaneously. Stephen Dedalus in Joyce's Ulysses called history a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. Karl Marx declared that the tradition of all the dead generations weighs like a mountain on the forehead of the living. Ralph Waldo Emerson decried his retrospective age and its dedication to building what he called the sepulchres of the fathers. Embosomed for a season in nature, whose floods of life stream around and through us, and invite us by the powers they supply to action proportioned to nature, why should we grope among dry bones of the past, or put the living generation into masquerade out of its faded wardrobe? The sun shines today also. There is more wool and flax in the fields. There are new lands, new men, new thoughts. Let us demand our own works and laws and worship. The Russian revolutionary musician Arseny E. Avramov, who in 1922 conducted his symphony of sirens from the top of a tall building in the port city of Baku, using semaphores, then the next year in Moscow, proposed to do something about the oppression of the past. He proposed to destroy all existing musical instruments. Avramov provides a good example of the historian's challenge. In his case, to reenact mentally the oppression of Tsarist Russia, the torpor of its exhausted peasant culture, and the fervor of apocalyptic belief powered by the romance of the machine, an immigrant Serbian physicist's phrase for the magic which so enraptured those Soviet revolutionaries, for whom the sight of a machine was in fact very rare. Machines were music to their young ears. On the other hand, historical knowledge liberates. Perhaps the best known of statements along such lines is George Santayana's, for whom history promised escape from ignorant repetition of its patterns. Niccolo Machiavelli characteristically advised the prudent man to follow the paths beaten by great men, so that if his ability does not equal theirs, at least it will savor of it. And in that famous aphorism of Newton, brilliantly explored by Robert Merton, of standing on the shoulders of giants, history is constructed as progressive liberation from ignorance. I have intimated much more, a liberation from our own historical provincialism, comfortable and smug, anxious and nostalgic, fearful and bigoted, take your pick, so that from the past's enabling constraints we can build a far better future for ourselves than we would otherwise drift into, just going as we are going. I have pointed to our mostly ignorant repetition over the past 40 years of the same tired arguments about who or what is to blame that text analysis is not the literary criticism's darling, and argued that historical knowledge will liberate us to do much better, or perhaps just to be wiser and happier in our obscurity. In my last lecture, I quoted the military historian John Lewis Gaddis, who argued that from the collision of mastery and oppression, which history reveals, wise maturity can result. He depicted, you will recall, a rather different sort of man standing at a height. Not the triumphant revolutionary conductor of sirens, foghorns, machine guns, and various other industrial equipment, but the simultaneously exultant and humble traveler, our bipolar historian. My task in the final lecture is to say what I think we can learn from such a preliminary survey as I have been able so far to complete. But again, I must insist, as full a recognition as possible, of how preliminary this survey is. If I did not think that the motherlode of material even as so far excavated, were as compelling as it is, and what it promises to enable us to do necessary, I would not venture at so premature a stage to drag out the stuff I have found and arrange it for you to admire in an order that I hope suggests its value. And here, suggesting the value of the Dictionary of the Words in the Wild. But this value for which I am writing is value to help address an intolerable situation in the present, that to date we have done so little justice to the literature we are assiduously digitizing, tagging, and mining. This is not to blame. That's not my purpose. Rather, as the sociologist W.G. Runciman said in his very British way about the revolutionary effects of quantitative studies in the Times Literary Supplement for 6th August 1971, no doubt the rewards of ingenuity, even if coupled with perseverance, are often meager. But this may mean that in due course, the opportunities for spectacular advance will be all the greater. It remains true that habits of mind usually take a generation to be overturned. We may have to wait 200 or 300 years before we know what are the most rewarding applications of quantitative methods to the sciences of man. And meanwhile, it is irrelevant, if not positively unhelpful, to carp at lack of immediate success. Now, nearly 40 years later, we know that thanks to the DEI and related efforts, impressive progress has been made with identifying textual structures, categorizing their entities, and providing mechanisms for their recall and transformation. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we have, in other words, built and paved the digital forecourts of literary studies, however much we may admire them. But in these lectures, I have been concerned not with these forecourts, but with that which they speed access to, indeed what they are for, interpretation, that is, reading in the scholar's sense. Unless I am badly mistaken, what all this progress is in aid of is, as it were, finding, fetching, and opening the book, or rather, Greg Crane's million books. Perhaps, as has been said, one does not read a million books, one mines them, extracts, crunches up, and smelts the ore, then casts the metal into something for use. Good, necessary work, but preliminary. My interest here has been in the use, the interpretative reading that surely must follow all those industrially aided preparations. From this interest follows a strong reason for looking back to the time of computing before the web, when scholarly concern with machines was their immediate and mostly solitary use to aid critical interpretation. So, what have I found? Let me summarize. I have argued that both positivist criticism and physical machinery constrained and shaped what literary scholars did with computing during the incunabular period, and that from the constraints we can derive lessons on the interrelation among theory, equipment, and practice. New criticism in its declining years shaped critical practice by a narrowing of vision to words on the page. The mainframe machinery shaped how literary scholars used computing by its rebarbative batch mode processing and by its reduction of already reduced text to mere character strings. As Stefan Sinclair has pointed out, the tools those scholars used, the same could be said of most of us now, created further constraints on interpretive literary computing by pulling the reader away from the reading text to one or more forms of it that discouraged reading or prevented it altogether. In the case of the keyword and context concordance, which H.P. Lund invented in the late 1950s, and which became the norm with interactive concording in the 1980s, format directed attention to linguistic rather than literary concerns. Hence the flowering of corpus linguistics from the pioneering work in literary computing. I have argued, however, that in this historical setting, scholars nevertheless fused computing and interpretive reading despite the unfavorable conditions. In other words, we can find in their work, though mostly by inference rather than directly, that they were managing to do with computing what we would suppose they'd do given the prevalent theoretical dispositions of the time. To put the matter bluntly, computers didn't stop them from reading and interpreting texts. however unsatisfactory an instrument we may think it was. Indeed, we find testimony enough, for example, in Susan Wittig's sober assessment of 1978, that criticism was benefited, though only in incremental ways. My focus here has been, as you know, on the possibilities for non-incremental, paradigm-shifting change. Do we say, then, that the computer was for them, and so for us, just a tool? That, as so many have intoned, it only does more quickly and conveniently what we could do without it? That the case for literary computing won't be made until we can come up with an achievement otherwise impossible? Anthony Kenny, you may recall, set that condition in his British Library lecture of 1992. Whatever now may be the case, it seems plausible that then, as many assessments attest, nothing was accomplished that could not have been done otherwise. But then or now, the absolutist condition set by Kenny and others runs afoul of two truths. First, that computing machines follow human instruction. Second, that as beings in time, time matters to us. The speed at which something happens makes qualitative difference that may, in fact, make all the difference. Note that I am not arguing for the notion that computers are faster than thought, as B.B. Bowden entitled his compilation of papers from a symposium in the early 1950s. As I said in my first lecture, we now know that the bottleneck is not the cyberneticist's human machine in the middle. Rather, I am arguing for results achieved by mechanical processes going on faster than we can, in fact, perform them in the time we have, and the self-censoring of our questions that results from our knowing we haven't the time. Are these results emergent phenomena, properly so-called? I just said that the absolutist argument is also defeated by the fact that machines only do what they're told. But as Herbert Simon comments in The New Science of Management Decision, published in 1960, this statement that computers can only do what they're programmed to do is intuitively obvious, indubitably true, and supports none of the implications that are commonly drawn from it. Most prominently, that autonomous artificial intelligence is therefore impossible. Time supplies the fundamental reason why such implications do not follow. I have therefore preferred to avoid absolutes, but instead to focus on the interplay between the two elements in the discourse of literary computing, criticism and machinery, which constrained each other. With Raymond Williams, you will recall from the third lecture, I argue that limits are set and pressures exerted both by people and their inventions within which variable social practices are profoundly affected but never necessarily controlled. While I realize that the argument over the question of technological determinism is much more complex than my brief statement has allowed, and that the relevant literature is far more extensive than I have comprehended in these lectures, I do suggest that Williams' range of possibilities offers a fruitful position from which we may begin picking apart the complex of constraints and influences. But determinism comes into play in another form as well. The degree to which our historical view is affected by the change in how research is now done, what we think it is. The most prominent change for humanities computing is the emphasis we now place on collaboration in teams. Collaboration is clearly necessary for some kinds of projects, but the institutional emphasis on it conditions more than just the way we think about our work. It must also affect how we look at the historical development of literary computing. Is it possible, then, that the historical inferences of someone like me, who works alone by choice and finds peril in the treatment of collaboration as a transcendental virtue, are misleading? Perhaps my governing analogy between scholar and craftsman, which leads me to zero in on the very private relationship between individual and tool, and to favor the phenomenological argument about attending from the tool to the work, as the paradigmatic blind man attends to what his stick tells him rather than to the stick itself, which is an intensely private, cognitive matter, is true enough for the so-called lone scholar, but is not so important otherwise. So, am I writing a history for a vanishing breed, my breed, as we tap our way along lonely pavements toward extinction? In other words, how we see the history of literary computing seems to depend on how we now believe, what we now believe about literary scholarship, in particular, what we think its core concern is. If this concern is for the interpretation of texts, for expanding the minds of readers by fulfilling the ancient communal role of the learned editor or commentator, then the focus must be on the intimacies of lone scholarship. For this focus to be on what passes among collaborating team members, then the concern would have to be with how digital resources are actually produced and used. That, it seems to me, can be the subject of very worthy scholarship of the social scientific kind, scholarship that badly needs to be done, but isn't itself scholarship. So I think my example is a safe one to use in proposing an historical development that mirrors the progression in hardware from shared mainframe to personal computer, that is, toward ever more privately directed tools. By design, my history does not take into account the radical shift in the primary locus of activity from analysis to communication, which was brought about by the web, introduced in August 1991. But again, what the web does is preparatory to my main event. I decided to end my history just before the web, not only because the period since 1991 is even more problematically recent and brings far greater amount of historical material into view. I set the terminus ad quem also because the second great phase in the development of computing raises a number of larger historiographical problems that would have made the completion of my project even less likely than it already is. Machines for communication have a much longer history that have to be taken into account from points of view as diverse as David Mendel's In Between Human and Machine, which I've already mentioned several times and greatly admire, Tom Standage's in The Victorian Internet, published in 1998, and David Hinken's in The Postal Age, published in 2006. Complicating the historical strands of communications engineering and social practice is, for example, Laura Otis's Networking, Communicating with Bodies and Machines in the 19th Century, published in 2001, which opens up intimate relationships between physical devices and neurophysiological ideas and imagery. Once again, McCulloch's and Pitt's Turing machine model of the brain comes into view, as does Claude Shannon's and Warren Weaver's information theory. Indeed, cybernetics, control and communication in animal and machine, by definition, again is essential to consider, but from a somewhat different angle. The very difficult idea, or as Jeffrey Nunberg has said, impression of information, becomes insuperably difficult to ignore. Hence a badly needed, far more complex history than I have time to write will remain to be written. The fact is that what enables us from the past, which I have here brought into view, seems precisely to be what our forebears ignored. The basket in which they put so many of their eggs, producing concordances of canonical texts, is now a subject primarily of historical interest, and not only because literary criticism went elsewhere. From our perspective, with our current needs, the problem of that time isn't that close reading of texts was by then critically out of fashion, and that therefore mechanization of a primary tool for the purpose uninteresting to most scholars. Rather, the problem is literary computing's indifference to the imaginative explorations going on energetically from the 1960s. I have mentioned Margaret Masterman's modeling of poetics, haiku in particular, but there are many other examples. I have hinted at and pointed toward the hugely important, generously funded, and very well publicized work in the technosciences that scholars in literary computing must have known about to some degree, if by no other means than local papers and magazines. I've attempted to account for the difficulties any of them might have faced, and one prominent scholar among them did face, in trying to learn from participating scientists and contribute to their debate. But there is an equally important, perhaps more accessible, less prominent, but equally ignored source of ideas and inspirations that is the subject of an as yet unwritten chapter of my book, Computing in the Arts. In 1962, the same year as Masterman wrote about a literary telescope of the mind for the Times Literary Supplement, the telecommunications engineer A. Michael Knoll began experimenting with computer art on an IBM 7090 mainframe at Bell Labs. By 1968, enough was going on in the art world for the major exhibition in London to which I've already referred, Cybernetic Serendipity, organized by Yashia Reichart, who edited the catalog and later a collection of papers, Cybernetics, Art, and Ideas, to which the cyberneticist maker of Maverick Machines, the mechanic philosopher Gordon Pask, contributed. Knoll and many others at the time were arguing, as he said, that the digital computer was not just an inanimate tool, but an intellectual and active creative partner that, when fully exploited, could be used to produce wholly new art forms and possibly new aesthetic experiences. At the end of my first lecture, I quoted Frank Dietrich's vision of a functioning harmonic symbiosis between man and machine. Dietrich used these words to characterize the relationship between the British painter Harold Cohen and his software Aaron, which Cohen began writing at the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab in 1973. As he said, to understand more about the nature of the art-making process than the making of art itself allows. With Aaron's improved abilities came significant artistic attention. For example, exhibitions in London, Amsterdam, New York, San Francisco, and elsewhere. At this juncture, we could play Turing's imitation game and ask his question. I think the machine, that is Aaron, would put one over on us. My argument, however, is that this is the wrong question to ask, the wrong way to look at what's going on. In AI, discussions of computer art and music seem often to compare their outputs to canonical works of high art such as Mozart or Picasso, with promises of equaling them one day. But from the time of Marcel Duchamp, John Cage, William Burroughs, Oulipo, and others, the distinction between art and not art has become increasingly deliberately blurred, for example, by found art, found sound, and mechanically produced poetry. It is now not uncommon, for example, to be confronted by an object in a major museum which is rather difficult to distinguish from objects found at the back of one's garden, or in an impromptu underground exhibition space, to have significant trouble sorting plumbing features from objects constructed by the artists. Both of these are personal experiences of my own, in the Tate Modern in London and in a grotty basement in Toronto rented by the artists for their show. I cannot but wonder if there is not a highly significant meeting here of computing on the one hand and artistic movement on the other. Or as I said and qualified earlier, these are cognate phenomena. But here I have two quite different points to make about our inheritance from such digital projects of the incunabular period. One is, despite all the dubious implications that computers have become creative, the uncanny feeling experienced when it is unclear whether a mind or merely an inanimate object is at hand. Or to put the pointing of uncanniness another way, whether the expression we take to be artistic comes from a human or a machine. Note here that it is not the judgment made, as in the Turing test, rather the uncertainty that is important, however momentary it may be. Thus, Peter Galison, summarizing Stanley Cavell's argument about the uncanny, comments on the incident reported by the engineer Gordon Stibitz in 1942 when viewing Norbert Wiener's anti-aircraft predictor, that, as Stibitz said, it was reading his mind. Galison goes on to add that each generation has its own conception of what constitutes a mind. In other words, that the uncanniness provoked by computing and its immediate predecessors marks both an encounter with an externalized form of that historical conception of mind and the start of a shift to another as the ghost in the machine vanishes into the machine. again a refiguration of the human here provoked by art, an arrival followed immediately by another departure. The other point about the inheritance of these early imaginative explorations is simply that they are as much ours as the rest, though in a world of art rather than literature, and that they retain for us now every bit as much of a challenge and opportunity as they did then, when our forebears ignored them. Current interest in such matters is chiefly, I think, but would be very glad to hear otherwise, in the cognitive sciences and in computer science, with both of which we should have a closer connection. Unless I have overlooked something, McGann's Ivanhoe, with its suggestion of a marriage between simulation and criticism, seems as far as we have gone with literary computing. But the challenge is there, a gift of the past, if not the present. What was once ignored and scorned seems to me now to be central. To quote Dietrich once more, a functioning harmonic symbiosis between man and machine. So what kind of an idea about or attitude to computing machinery does a functioning harmonic symbiosis require? In the second lecture, I quoted Sir Charles Jeffrey Vicar's warning in 1971 that to succumb to the dangerously strong temptation of amoral slave labor from computing would bury its intellectual potential. I argued that this was so and is so because machine as slave is coextensive with computing as drudgery, and vice versa. I am not denying that there are tedious things to be done, which are better automated, such as vexed Charles Babbage at the beginning of the 19th century. The temptation against which Vickers warned us is not relief from senseless labor. Rather, the ceaseless assignment of more and more to the status of drudgery so that the slave machine can take the perceived burden away. Hence, unchecked, the danger is that engagement with actual work slips away, and so contact with the anomalous realities that would otherwise provoke new understandings of the subject. At the same time, conceiving of the machine as slave is tempting because it so readily sorts the threat the machine poses to human self-conception. Making slaves of others has a long history that here comes into view and would, I suspect, repay our attention manyfold. Slaves are for getting jobs done, for producing results with no backtalk. In Robert Altman's film, Gosford Park, in 2001, the head housekeeper, Mrs. Wilson, played by Dame Helen Mirren, schools one of her underlings and gives a chilling portrait of herself and those whom mastery has infantilized. "What gift do you think a good servant has that separates him from the others?" she asks, and then replies, "It is the gift of anticipation, and I am a good servant. I am better than good. I am the best. I am the perfect servant. I know when they'll be hungry and the food is ready. I know when they'll be tired and the bed is turned down. I know it before they know it themselves. I am the perfect servant. I have no life." So I wonder, what is now our vision of the world of desire? Is it, in Northrop Frye's words, a world with a human face? Is it, as Ovid depicts in the Metamorphoses, a world once alive with movement and voices that is petrified and fallen silent? Or is it only atoms and the void, as the intellect declares in a dialogue of Democritus? If it has a human face, then what sort of a face do we want? The face of a slave smiling up at us? In a recent book edited by Yorick Wilkes, Close Engagements with Artificial Companions, Key Social, Psychological, Ethical, and Design Issues, Joanna Bryson argues from the assumed fact that we are to own these companions and from ethical dilemmas they would pose that, as she says in the title of her paper, robots should be slaves. We know from studies over the past 3 decades that computer anxiety is not simply a matter of technical ignorance or unfamiliarity, but quite complex and highly persistent. We know, for example, from public reactions to the 2009 ASILOMAR conference that I've mentioned before, Not only that the American public is still easily disturbed by prospects of what AI might do, but that as co-chairs Eric Horvitz and Bart Selman wrote in their official interim report of that meeting, despite deep enthusiasm and optimism about the future influence of AI research and development on the world, and skepticism of the radical views expressed by futurists and science fiction writers, the experts are sufficiently concerned about the potential rough edges, as they call them, that might arise in the intersection of AI research and society to go to the trouble and expense of a major gathering. Unlike the scientists of the Manhattan Project, they can make no calculation as to whether an intelligence explosion, as they say, will ignite the mental atmosphere of our cognitive world and burn our thoughts to a crisp. I intend here no position on these possibilities, nor pretend sufficient knowledge of the vast literature on science fiction, science fact, and learned commentary. My only purpose for now is to indicate briefly how interesting the times are in which we live, and that the historical times I have discussed in my lecture bear closely on how we might choose to proceed. At the beginning of this lecture, I referred to George Santayana's idea that history gives us a chance to escape from repeating old mistakes. That is, to see that there is a problem because there was one, and so to have the wit to choose otherwise. We do have a problem, and it is an old problem. I have argued throughout these lectures that from the critics' point of view, literary computing has not done much more these last many years than to build and pave the forecourts of interpretation. From the beginning, some critics thought it could do far more, but were ignored. The frequently lamented fact that mainstream critics had ignored computing was interpreted either as a sign that the whole undertaking for criticism had exhausted itself and was getting nowhere, or that others were to blame, as I've said. I've highlighted the historical arguments pointing to dominance of a positivistic criticism, which was recognized at the time to be a major impediment. I have argued that slow, rebarbative equipment strengthened positivistic attitudes and discouraged an interactive relationship with the machine that would have fostered, and later on did foster, a very different sort of computing. This idea of text and the computing to go with it put the critic and the machine on much the same theoretical playing field, and so threatened his or her self-conception. Hence the fear that, as I have argued, such an important historical clue and goes far beyond the small circle of practitioners whom we identify with. In other words, at the same time and in the same places, communicated to scholars involved with literary computing through numerous popular channels were several enveloping or overlapping or crisscrossing discourses. Here I fumble for the right term, but after a certain amount of agonizing and with some uncertainty, I return to Paul Edwards' term, discourse. He means, you will recall, an amalgam of tools, metaphors, politics, and culture. As he says, the entire field of signifying or meaningful practices, a way of knowledge, a background of assumptions and agreements about how reality is to be interpreted and expressed, supported by paradigmatic metaphors, techniques, and technologies, and potentially embodied in social institutions. I think what makes me uncomfortable with the term discourse is the sense of closure that it suggests, the tendency of arguments based on the idea, such as Edwards and Hale's, to assume the paranoid style, explaining, as I said, all too much. My use of the term in the plural, and somewhat loosely, gets around the problem of paranoid argument, but raises another, namely how various discourses interrelate, especially when they share component features. How do the various divergently originating strands of historical development interrelate? But this is far too difficult a question for me to tackle now. Three of the discourses I leave to others. First, the discourse of the Cold War, which overlaps almost exactly in time with the period I am studying and helps to explain the prevalent fear of computing throughout it. Second, the industrial, commercial, and administrative discourse, which communicated the developments of computing through advertising and the presence of machinery in the business sector. Third, the imaginative discourse of fiction, science fiction, cartoons, comics, and cinema, which Catherine Hales has treated quite well in How We Became Posthuman. The discourse of art I have just merely touched on, but clearly it must become a chapter of the book which I am attempting to preview in this series of lectures. I think it could have a great deal to do with the future of scholarly computing as a whole for us fellow makers of things. The discourse of the sciences, which I have represented here only by cybernetics, and cybernetics almost exclusively through one paper given at one of its major conferences, deserves to get and will get much fuller treatment as the book develops. There are a number of people from this time who could have played a most important role on our side had the opportunity arisen. The physicist Donald McCrimmon McKay, for example, the anthropologists Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead, the mathematicians John von Neumann and Norbert Wiener, and so on. But perhaps the figure who could have contributed the most is the philosophical neurophysiologist Warren Sturgis McCulloch. As chair of the Macy conferences, including the one at which Richard spoke, he had surprisingly almost nothing to say in response. But he was in many respects Richard's counterpart on the scientific side, the person with whom, from those years, I would most like to be in the audience here alongside with Richard's. The intelligence explosion his presence would bring about would be a very fine way to go. It says far more about us than about him that he is barely known today, but I have plans to help to do something about that. Apart from giving us more reading to do, these people, the program of the Macy conferences in which they participated, and the steady widening of scope of my investigations should suggest a final as well as an initial lesson, that progress is not to be made by staying safely within the precincts of a single discipline. I hope to have persuaded you that our future needs our past. That past cannot answer to the future without a proper history, and no such history can be written without taking account of all that has met in the crossroads of computing. Whatever else may be said about interdisciplinarity and the refiguration of disciplines that genuine interdisciplinary research forces on us, humanities computing is more like a ship of exploration among the islands of an archipelago than it is like a new domain on a crowded continent, or yet another branch of a very old tree. So if we are not to be condemned to relive the rather disappointing past of literary computing, we need to look as far afield as it takes to find out who is working on problems similar to those we know about, or on problems we should be having but aren't yet aware of. If the past of literary computing is a reliable guide, we should not be surprised to discover that we have much to contribute as well. These other disciplines likely to contribute to our future are not difficult to find, since thanks to all that cybernetics brought together, most are included in the broad church of the cognitive sciences. And we, if any people, are good at finding things. The key is ethnographic. The key is learning. In the words of another of the greats, the Australian ethnohistorian Greg Denning, to cross the beaches of the mind. Is this not what literature does for us? Thank you very much.
All right, we will open the floor for questions.
You'll note I allowed for a generous amount of time for questions. There are a lot more playful images of this man than that one. That one is the one that glowers at you from the cover of this book, which I think is a real treasure. He apparently had a big, generous house in, I think it was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and took people in all the time, including this stray genius, Walter Pitts.
Who's Walter Pitts?
Pitts, as a youth, he had a monster of a father, so he spent most of his time on the streets. And one day some bullies were bullying him, so he ran into the local library and plunked down in the stacks again. He turned, according to his own account, and saw a copy of the relatively new Principia Mathematica. Bertrand Russell and Whitehead pulled it off and read it. Took him a few days. Then he wrote a letter to Russell saying that he thought it was quite a good work and it would be good to discuss it. So Russell wrote back, Bertrand Russell wrote back and said, you should come to Cambridge and study with me. But that didn't happen. I mean, Pitts didn't have any money. So Pitts eventually had to get away from his father, so he fled to Chicago. He's 15, 16 years old, fled to Chicago, was sleeping in the park near the University of Chicago, where he ran into an old man named Bert. And Bert said, this is Bertrand Russell, of course, Bert said, there's this guy at the university, Rudolf Carnap, who has just written this interesting book. You should get it and read it. Somehow, or maybe he gave Pitts the book, I don't know. But anyway, Pitts read the book. And then he found Carnap's office, knocked on the door and went in. He said to Carnap, on page 260, there's something that's not very clear. Look, it just so happened that for Carnap, the expression not very clear meant nonsense. And Carnap, pulls his new book off the shelf and looks to the page, and sure enough, it wasn't very clear. So Pitts got a job. The story ends badly. Pitts went insane. He was on the edge almost all the time. His friends tried to persuade him to get a PhD, but every time he was given the exam, he criticized the questions and angered the examiner, so he never did get a PhD. But McCulloch would hand him ideas. Pitts was a mathematician, among other things, and Pitts would make them rigorous. So the two worked very closely together for quite a long time. Anyway, that's Walter Pitts. There's a biography of him in an article that I can send you if you're interested. Yeah?
Well, I'm actually reading How We Became Post-Human right now.
Yeah.
And something that struck me as interesting and true that you said was that we shouldn't just stick within one discipline, I guess. If it's interdisciplinary, we should embrace that. But something that I was reading through is she focuses a great deal of her work on what Wiener, is that the correct way to say it?
Norbert Wiener?
Right.
The cybernetician, mathematician.
Right, and he felt that cybernetics best not penetrate the boundaries of other disciplines. So I was just wondering what your take on that was.
He thought that.
Yeah, he thought.
It's odd. I'd have to read the context because he was busily going wherever his mind took him. Cybernetics pulled in people from all over and became, as Peter Gallison's article on called The Ontology of the Enemy, is in Critical Inquiry a few years back, 1991 or 92, is quite interesting. Which deals with Wiener, a view of Wiener which one often does not get. Wiener came to believe that cybernetics offered a cosmological principle, that it explained everything, that it brought in. I mean, it seemed to apply wherever one looked, which is why these Macy conferences drew the top intellectuals in the sciences and many in the social sciences and medicine at the time, because it seemed to be so widely applicable. And Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead thought it, to be immediately applicable to deal with many of the serious social problems that came out of the Second World War. So I don't know. I mean, I'd have to read. Wiener was quite an amazing fellow, another one of these, like Pitts, only more stable.
I have another really rambling, vague, incoherent question. But over the series of talks that you've given, I'm amazed by the kind of rhetoric around computers. computers should be slaves, or are computers slaves? And as I mentioned in one of the other lectures, I think that there's a kind of really profound class anxiety built into that. And then today I was even wondering if that might even be racial anxiety, that the ways in which race and class get worked out in culture, the computer becomes a kind of a lightning rod for all of those kinds of anxieties. And they just start to, manifest themselves in very vehement, vocal, emotional ways. If we had a different metaphor of computers, might not even be appropriate or applicable. But I was wondering if you could comment on that a little bit, I guess. If you've seen that, or if I'm not wholly mistaken in that kind of approach, but based on the stuff that you've read,
class and race differences. Oh yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's how do we handle real difference? And this touches us now. This is not something that happened in the south of America in the last 150, 200 years ago. This happens whenever we encounter difference. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with religious difference we thought for a diluted time to be an issue of the past, as we were all desecularizing ourselves and the whole world? Now it appears quite the opposite. So we have a problem of difference. How do we cope with it? How do we cope with it when it really, really matters? And insofar as we see what computing can do, it is spooky. I mean, when Wiener saw Stibitz's anti-aircraft predictor, he says he was spooked, made the hair stand up on the back of his neck, because it seemed to be anticipating what he thought. And we know that this progress is a steady forward march. It's technological. And at each threshold, it spooks us. And that's, I think, a good thing. It's scary as hell, but it's a good thing. And it's part of a very basic cultural pattern of a cycling through our visions and revisioning them every time. And this encounter with difference is one way of putting it. I have one book, I can't remember the title of it now, on slavery, which I intend to read because I think it's central. And there are articles, not only the one I referred to in the 2010 book, edited by Yorick Wilkes, on companions, the Artificial Companions Project, which is to make fuzzy things to keep old people happy, among other things. Fuzzy things that, talk to you and respond when you say things and stuff. Not only that article, but also articles earlier. There's one in particular that I can't remember the title or author of, in which from the 70s, in which this person who's a computer engineer in the UK said, "We have been talking about computers as slaves, but I think it's time we started talking about them as servants." And he makes some distinction between servants and the difference between servants and slaves.
Yeah. Maybe they move from race to class.
Move from race to class, yes, perhaps. But it can easily move back.
Yeah, right. But then, within that entire context, which is really big and I'm just still sort of working my way through, the comment that you made, and I hope I'm not misquoting, is that Turing, in sort of playing the imitation game and what's become the Turing test, right, is this, is it a computer or is it a human? You alluded that that was exactly the wrong question to ask. That Turing is asking, in some sense, the wrong question. And it struck me because it's an omnipresent question. I mean, everybody's asking that question all of the time in fiction. And Kate Hale starts her book with, an analysis of Turing. And I wonder, I never thought about the idea that maybe that was the wrong question to be asking and that we should maybe stop asking that question. But maybe we should, because it's in asking that question in the way that he does that we import all of this baggage of race and class back into the question.
Well, it's a hugely important article, that 1950 article.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's hugely important.
And it's a hugely important question, but it's my argument, which I've had with some computer scientists and not satisfactorily to my way of thinking, is that this question is based on old machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Machinery that you ask a question to, and then you sit there twiddling your thumbs, and you get a response back. We don't have machines like that anymore on the other side of walls. We have right here, and for some of us, even inside. Pacemakers are computers, and you know it'll get only more so as time goes on. We know. So my point, I suppose, is as you collapse the time interval down to whatever that threshold, get over that threshold to start talking about resonance instead of elapsed time, instead of turnaround time, that the question to ask is about that being spooked, is about that moment of uncertainty. Okay, I get the response back, is it a computer, is it a human, you know, is it a boy or is it a girl, as people used to sing at me in the 60s. It's that boundary crossing unease, that moment at which familiarity dissolves away and the world as it is then unmade becomes for a moment visible. And this is Blake's expanding eyes of man. That's what North Fry is talking about. It's what poetry does to you, is defamiliarizes, as the Russian formalist said, forgive me for my constantly referential style, defamiliarize the world to make it shine anew. The point about the fact that the fields are full of flax and wheat. We have new things. They're all around us. That there is an aspect to the past which is a dead end. And when we push it off, we can see things new. We can have that moment of vision, which the enemy of which is familiarity and race and class and all the rest of the prison equipment that we use to keep ourselves from getting spooked. Jeffrey.
So I'm going to press you some more on this rather disappointing past of literary computing. Because it seems to me that you're, in effect, using an interpretive lens to close off the very capacity to see and take delight in all sorts of stuff in the past. So I want to try a couple of things on you. One would be the amazingly rich history of interactive fiction, both in the game world, the text adventures, to the hypertext fictions, hypermedia fictions, right up to things like Kirschenbaum's Mechanisms, where we have people actually talking seriously about how we could do the bibliography of such works, or the project that Adam Yu and Matt Kirschenbaum were involved in with William Gibson's Agrippa, trying to actually do the bibliography on that. So there would be one trajectory that I would say that has been surprising, that has been paradigm shifting, that has fit all the things that you're requiring of this aesthetic symbiosis. I'm surprised that you're turning to art rather than something a little bit closer. This is literary, a text adventure, and all of its descendants to the enormous and rich and sometimes irritating game industry that we have now is surely paradigm changing. Why are you ignoring that?
Partly I seem to have miscommunicated, and partly the answer is that I'm simply casting my eyes around and they happen to fall on computer art.
Okay.
And I got fascinated. But the miscommunication is I'm talking about mainstream literary criticism, not what the nutcases are doing the interesting nutcases. I mean, the people on the periphery, like Matt Kirschenbaum, the hypertext fiction people.
How is that on the periphery when Afternoon gets published in the Norton Anthology of Short Fiction?
Oh, maybe I just haven't read enough of the mainstream stuff to see this. But it seems to me that what this is teaching us, certainly in the period under investigation, wasn't heated. It wasn't heated at all. And people keep saying that it wasn't heated.
So perhaps what I've misunderstood about you, you're not saying that you think this history is rather disappointing. You're simply saying that the mainstream literary critics find what is happening in computing disappointing. But you're not disappointed.
I am disappointed. Perhaps that's just because I'm ignorant of the good stuff that I haven't seen yet. Certainly the critics of the time were disappointed. The ones that had their eyes open enough to see what or to imagine what might be possible. I don't know. I really don't know about this.
So you actually... I think, let me try another thing, and this is just a straight question of, I missed something you were saying. You made an interesting shift. You were talking about collaboration. I understood the end of it, where you were arguing why you placed the 90s and the web as the end of the confabulary shift. And that actually makes a lot of sense, that, you know, this makes sense as an epic. But on the one hand, you've been talking a lot about how much we can learn from cognitive science. On the other hand, I thought I heard you dismissing as not being scholarship the possibility of collaborative interpretation. You seem to say there's lots of good scholarship to study how collaborations take place, but you don't seem open to the possibility that interpretation could be collaborative. You seem committed to sort of an epistemic loneliness, that interpretation cannot happen in two people talking or in a law court or in all sorts of other situations, which the cognitive scientists seem to be saying now are forms of distributed interpretation.
No, you're right. I mean, interpretation does happen in conversation.
Is that how you imagine you talk about what you're hoping and imagining could be is a, you had a phrase, harmonic symbiosis. Perhaps a form of conversation with a computer where the time interval has been brought to a point where one isn't irritated by it.
I suppose that, well, my own experiences of having many fine conversations with people while I'm working on things, and these being inspiring, but that what comes out of it is I write something, and I'm zeroing in on that moment when I write something.
So
there are not two people's sets of hands on the keyboard. They're mine. Now, I may write something and send it to somebody with whom I am co-authoring a piece, which I have done. Not a lot, but I have done it. And we may rewrite each other's prose. But I'm zeroing in on the moment when I look at a text and understand it, or misunderstand it, as the case may be. That private cognitive moment, which is not shared.
So you are open to the possibility that there are forms of interpretation that are collaborative, where the output might not be your writing.
Yes,
it might be
sure.
This conversation we're having and other people getting what they wish out of it. So you're, in particular now, you're not disappointed necessarily by all the advances and paradigm changes in collaborative interpretation. You're disappointed in the lack of paradigm change in private interpretation.
Yes. I mean, this conversation...
You wouldn't dismiss that there have been some very interesting shifts, possibly, in paradigm shifts and collaborative interpretation?
It's not so much a question of dismissing as it is being disturbed by the degree to which collaboration has become, as Peter Galison says, a transcendental virtue, something which is good without qualification, good for all times and all places, all circumstances. The rhetoric you get from central administration is that collaboration is good and lone scholar, which is a slur, is bad. And I think that is absolute political nonsense. That collaboration is good, and some of the best experiences I've had of my scholarly life have been in collaboration with other people. That this is a manifestation of a collaborative enterprise. That what makes this place so interesting to me, I mean, this HUCO and, you know, stuff in Alberta, so interesting, is the strong emphasis on collaboration and what you're getting out of it. I mean, it's very exciting stuff. But I say we are not well served by a political rhetoric which makes collaboration a transcendental virtue, that isn't critical about collaboration, that doesn't say, okay, for this project, I really do need to collaborate, but for this project, I won't. Because it in the nature of the point is that what matters is the nature of the work. What do you want to do as a person? You know, what kind of research do you want to do? Then you ask, what does it require to get this research done? Not, I'm going to collaborate and then figure out later what we're going to do. Or, I'm only going to think of projects which require collaboration because that's the only way I can do research.
I have no disagreement about the excesses. The excess enthusiasm towards collaboration as an end in itself. In fact, I think the cognitive scientists who talk about distributed cognition, you know, warn that, the big problem getting a bunch of people together to talk about something or committees is if everyone agrees, you actually have a sort of deadening of diversity of opinions on that thing. Yeah. They're quite clear that any old arrangement of people in a room isn't going to lead to anything. I guess what I'm wondering is the possibility that if you're right that there is in the 90s a major shift in computing towards communication, could it be that the great contribution towards interpretation of computing is opening up a variety of making possible for collaborative interpretation to happen with different types of outcomes, not necessarily written out. Different types of outcomes, and that could be one of the gifts that we also have to look at. Not does it replace your investigation of the private interpretation?
And private and collaborative interpretation are on a convergent course with each other, in the sense that what I'm talking about and what I'm trying to get my head around, the next step past Ivanhoe sort of thing, the resonance of human and machine. The model for it that attracts me over and over and over again is the conversational or improvisational model. That you react, that the machine is to you, as Yorick Wilkes calls it, a companion, but an intellectual companion. So it's not, you know, thinking up something and then using the computer to test it and then rethinking it. It's being in a conversational exchange in which we model forward into something that we do not yet know. And that can happen with humans, with other humans, and with a machine of the right sort, perhaps, if the artificial intelligentsia can manage it. You see what I mean by the convergent courses of these two things? That I don't think we're really talking about two different things, but ultimately the same thing. Which is that resonance with somebody or something else.
I think I would argue that the gifts of dialogue are almost always appreciated by the eavesdropper. And so So there is this, you know, one view of dialogue says that, for example, in teaching, that Socratic, the Socratic method is one where you, you know, the Socrates character hammers Ali into some form of, through, you know, these pointed questions, hammers her to the point where she comes to some new level of knowledge. But when you actually read the Platonic dialogues carefully and Xenophon's description of how Socrates actually operated, you know, nobody that Socrates questioned left any happier or more knowledgeable. It's the it's all the people that Plato tells us were in the room that are actually the ones. So that would suggest that in some sense the dialogue, the conversation of the computer, to use Turing's imitation game, which is based on dialogue. It's sort of, you know, the computer will be intelligent when it can have a dialogue with us. It won't be a gift to either the computer or the interlocutor. It'll be a gift to those who are listening in. It's the if you will, the eavesdroppers that will benefit and will find this, will find some new knowledge. Most dialogues that in our tradition, the interlocutors leave frustrated and unhappy and not agreeing. And that's what makes them such great works of art.
Our very conversation in these last few minutes would seem to contradict this. Now, maybe it is true that everyone else on both sides of the table will leave the room much better than they came in because of the conversation that we had, and we will go out disgruntled and suppressing our anger at each other in order to remain friends. But I think that at least I have learned, I mean, what my reward for having come all these miles to here to give these lectures is not only to have a bunch of stuff I can make into a book, but it is those very questioning, doubting remarks that you have made, which that's the real reward of doing this, is that questioning. So, I mean, maybe I'm the person you've hammered into.
It's gracious of you to say that, because I would say that the reverse is also true to have.
Well, I was hoping you'd say that, because you're now contradicting yourself. I mean, the two of us have enormously profited. I at least I have, from this conversation. So the dialogue, Socratic dialogue is one form of dialogue. This is a much more equal dialogue, I think.
There's a second tradition, the Ciceronian dialogue. Anyway, I you know.
You wrote your dissertation on dialogue.
I suppose that's probably a good point to stop. We're at 10 after. One last question.
I'm maybe in some ways it follows from what was asked by Jeffrey, but I'm curious about your turn to the discourse on art. You said there is you know three different discourses I'm going to leave to others, and I'm turning, and you sort of gave us a sense of why, but just a very little sense. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about why the discourse of art seems promising or in need of further work at this juncture.
I really don't know. I mean, it's a sense of, it's a smell of food on the wind. And I don't know at this stage. I mean, I think those other things, I think I can find enough scholarship in those other areas that's been done better than I could possibly do in the amount of time I have, so that out of a sense of survival, I say there are these other things and I'm not going to deal with them. Not because I think they're interesting or unimportant or anything else. It's just that, you know, this is a big project. I want to complete it. And art, the computer art, I'm just fascinated by.
But it can't be completed because you're talking about history and we're making history all the time. So.
Yeah, but I do want to have a manuscript to send to a publisher.
You will.
To get it into circulation so that lots of people will read it and stuff.
But there won't be an ending.
No, there won't be I will certainly have an ending, but there won't be an ending to the topic, I hope. Yeah. And thank you all so much for your attention, rather remarkable amount of attention over 5 lectures. I think it's astonishing that anyone would come to all 5.
That's nothing. I need to get your podcasts. So I would miss the first few.
Yes. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.